Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life.
Welcome to The Questions, episode 627.
Today, Jeannie sends in feedback and a question regarding podcast demographics.
Where did you get the demographic that most podcast listeners are college-educated or upper-middle-class? As an avid-slash-rabid podcast listener, many of my friends are, likewise, podcast fans, and we run the gamut. While I won't disagree that there are valid data points, I know a world of people who are self-educated and or decidedly on the low end of the income gap. Perhaps the statistics are skewed because of a self-reporting bias? How does the market view itself based on incomplete numbers? I understand why, but in what ways are the audiences dismissed because they aren't on the charted statistical radar? How can one know when an audience becomes less poor and able to consume for actual cashy money?
Well, Jeannie, you're suffering from a subspecies of the no true Scotsman fallacy, which is that no Scotsman would do that, at least none of the ones I've seen. In this case, the demographic you're talking about definitely exists, the self-educated or the poorly educated that also enjoy podcasts. The self-educated, of course, depending on the stats breakouts you look at, they either count among the educated or there's college-educated and then there's non-college-educated, the broken out separately, and there isn't a poorly educated part. But according to statisticians, self-educated people are not educated because they don't have a degree. But they are accounted for in the stats. The underlying phenomenon, of course, is that people who listen to podcasts, especially people who listen to podcasts about something other than music or movies, are more likely to have an IQ of over about 110, 120 points, which doesn't put you in genius land, but does put you in above average intelligence land. Below that, it's very uncommon for someone to have that kind of curiosity. It's not unheard of, it's just uncommon. The statistics do account for the existence of these minority groups in the sample. It's just that the vast majority of podcast listeners are college-educated and middle to upper-middle class and whatnot. And the reason, of course, is that the more educated you are, the more demanding you are of your entertainment, generally speaking, and the more you can, generally speaking, afford the kinds of expensive devices and services that podcasts are delivered on. Doesn't mean you're the only group. The stats are about 55 to 68% of podcast listeners are college educated. These numbers come from podcast marketing research groups that are selling advertising. They help set the advertising rates. This is what the industry is based on. So, the next part of the question is the really interesting part, because what you're talking about when you talk about cultivating a minority audience is what we're all doing here. That's what fiction writers do. None of us, almost none of us, in fact, there may never be another one, is going to have a book that reaches everybody. Books that used to be everybody had to read them, like Harry Potter, like Shogun, like Twilight, for heaven's sake. There are mass phenomenon books. They're very rare. They've dependably happened every 2 to 5 years in the world of traditional publishing. Since indie publishing has come in, they've almost completely disappeared. So what do you do? Well, you can't please everybody. Now that everybody can get their tastes met, they're going to find or try to find the things that meet their tastes. So what you have to do as a writer is the most difficult of jobs when it comes to marketing. You have to find the people who already want what you've got but don't know it yet. Which means that you have to, when you take your writing hat off and put your marketing hat on, you have to find a way to understand your work as an audience member, and that is really, really tough. Especially considering that you are not the typical audience member. Forget the fact that you wrote that book. The fact that you're a writer means that you are not the typical audience member. You have a relationship with every piece of artwork that you consume on a whole different level than you did before you started writing. And even before you started writing, the fact that you've become a writer indicates that you always had a different relationship with these works than the people who didn't become writers. Some part of you was sitting in the back of your head saying, you know, I could write that so much better. Or, oh, I wish I could write like that. Normal people don't do that. They just encounter the work and enjoy it. And, of course, there's a spectrum, right? There's some normal people who think they could be great writers if they only tried, but they're not interested. So it's a really, really tough job to figure out who your works appeal to. And then you have to sell it to them. And that's tough, too. It's taken me years to be able to articulate who, for example, the Suave Rob books would appeal to. Because what kind of a demented weirdo would want to read a story of a ultra-macho transsexual dude who wants to do all the adrenaline-y things in the universe and has no regard whatsoever for anybody else's feelings? Nobody. By having him be a transsexual dude, you've completely thrown out the adrenaline junkie demographic that typically goes for adventure novels. By having it be science fiction, you've also pulled it out of the adventure novel genre. By having it be science fiction about weird, crazy stunts, you've pulled it out of hard science fiction, no matter how hard the underlying science you have involved is. And by having the guy be kind of a smug asshole, you've totally turned off anybody who insists on likable characters. How do you market something like this? Then I saw Archer. Archer is Suave Rob in a James Bond suit. It's the same kind of thing. And we're in Archer's final season now, so we're going to be doing a marketing push for Suave Rob to fans of Archer who are going to be missing their fix. Might not work, but it's the best idea I've gotten so far. And it was hard. I wrote the first Suave Rob book 8 years ago? And the final one's finally coming out in the next week and a half. And it was really hard because I loved it. Suave Rob is one of those books that I can read back and forget I wrote it. Because there's something about it that's just, it reminds me of my days surfing and that sense of unconstrained fun. And it's very hard to find things that have a sense of unconstrained fun. I've got a list of books and movies that have that kind of unconstrained fun in it. Not all of them have assholes as main characters, by the way. And they're like gold to me. I love that sense of utter freedom and play. And it's not easy to find. It's really hard to do in fiction. And the formula is never going to work well for two different people, because some people find things that are a lot of fun that other people find very upsetting or uncomfortable or offensive. And some people find things that are really fun that other people find completely dull and boring. So it's a really hard cocktail to mix, and I'm a very difficult audience to mix that cocktail for a lot of weird psychological reasons. So it hits my fun button, and I have been stuck on the fact that it hits my fun button and I don't know how to give it to anyone else for years until someone pointed out to me. I say I saw Archer and then immediately it clicked, but it didn't. I was watching Archer for years before someone pointed out to me that it was like watching Suave Rob as a cartoon. It was someone else had to do that for the penny to drop. But that's the kind of thing you have to do. Once you figure out who that niche is, what characteristics they might have, then in this world of hyper-targeted advertising and privacy invasion, you can leverage the tools of the nanny state, the Big Brother, and the surveillance apparatus looking over your shoulder. You can leverage those tools to narrowcast and target your advertising to just the sorts of people that probably would be interested, or that you hope would probably be interested. You know, it's sort of like stealing coal from the fires of hell in order to cook food. But, you know, every bad thing has one or two good uses here and there, right? So you can do that. Or if you aren't comfortable doing that, and heaven knows I don't blame you because I'm not really comfortable doing that. If you're not comfortable doing that, you can take that knowledge and you can do it the old-fashioned way. You go through affinity groups. You go to fan groups online. You find out where these people live and breathe that like the kinds of things that mean they probably would like the sorts of things that you're doing. And you do your marketing the old-fashioned way. You buy ads on those forums. You encourage your fans to join those groups if they have that interest. You do like we used to do in the podcasting world and do favor trades with people who have the same kinds of audience. You know, you put an excerpt of your novel in the back of theirs. They put an excerpt of their novel in the back of yours. All these methods that go back to the heyday of Penny Dreadful Publishing in the 1890s, they all still work. It's just a lot of legwork. So that kind of takes care of most of your question. Audiences that get dismissed, well, they're just ripe for marketing to, because if they're not getting service, that's a market that's hungry. And sometimes you never know that that market is there until you create something for them. The impression that you get from reading economics, reading about supply and demand, is that demand gives rise to the idea to create a supply. And sometimes that happens, but usually what happens is that someone creates something new, and then they got to find an audience for it. So they figure out how to create the demand once they've got the supply. And once they create the demand, if it has a broad enough appeal, the demand will catch on and the demand will start driving the system. So if there are groups that aren't caught by these survey methods, that's how you find them. Now, the thing about the survey methods is it's not that people aren't caught by the surveys. A survey that is well done will capture everybody, but it won't capture everything relevant. Just because you're Asian and upper middle class and Asian upper middle class and female doesn't mean that you don't like watching Boys in the Hood while you listen to rap music and drive along in a lowrider car with hydraulics. It just means you're a lot less likely to than a 19-year-old black guy from West Oakland who lived in the 90s because Boys in the Hood was a thing in the 90s. There's broad trends and then there's individuals. And marketing surveys go for broad trends. They're looking at demographic data. They're not looking, generally speaking, at interest groups. The hyper-particular surveillance-y stuff that Facebook does and that Twitter does that allowed Obama and Trump both to get elected because both of them were using the same kinds of advertising data in ways that no one was before, and that before the social media companies were around were generated by Dick Morris for the first and second Clinton campaigns that allowed Bill Clinton to get elected. Those kinds of hyper-specific, very invasive demographic research that look at interest patterns among demographic groups and then deliberately targets the minority population preferentially in circumstances through which the minority population can be motivated more easily than the majority population can. Those are the techniques that have gotten three presidents elected. Those are the techniques that Facebook advertising and Google advertising, God help us all, allow us access to as writers. But, as you can see with Dick Morris and the Clinton campaign, you can do that stuff on your own without the big data demographics if you want to. And there's reasons you might want to. First of all, Facebook defrauds people. They sell ads they don't run. They've had problems with this. They've been caught out on it three times in the last 4 years. So there's always that question over whether the ads you're paying for will work. Probably on average they will, but you always run that risk. And if you have a very limited budget, that's one of the risks you take, because you're going to have a lot of fun taking Facebook to court. They've got bigger lawyers than you. And it's very hard to prove something that's going on inside their ecosystem. Amazon ads, same kind of thing. They target based on customer relations. They, however, so far have a sterling reputation for delivering what they sell. BookBub does the same kind of things. They target based on their own accreted interest group demographics inside their newsletters. So every time someone who gets a BookBub ad clicks on a book to buy it, they get information about what that person bought, and that person gets shuffled into a pile that puts the books in the next BookBub ad in a particular order with the books that that person is most likely to want at the top, and they continually adjust them with everything. That's why BookBub is so successful, and why everyone else is trying to duplicate BookBub has sort of hit and miss success. So that's how you do it. Those are the old ways, those are the new ways. You find your interest group and you market to them. And as far as when an interest group gets money, well, you can tell that when they start buying stuff. Even if they don't have a lot of money, if they're sufficiently motivated, they'll buy stuff. Dirt poor farmers in the South in the 1920s threw gobs of money at travel and salvation shows. They didn't have a lot of money, but they threw the money at the Traveling Salvation Show, sometimes to their great detriment. If you can generate enough interest, people will give their money to you whether they want to or not, which gets into a whole other area of ethics that could generate a discussion that goes on for hours. But that's the truth. Unless you're selling a product that requires credit to get it, if you're selling something that costs $100, $200, $300, $1,000, $30,000, $100,000, then income bracket is really super relevant to you. If you're selling something that's $5, income bracket's not very relevant. When you're looking at the pool of people who have $5 to spend on something, yeah, they're not going to spend as many $5 as someone with twice the income or twice the cash flow. Two different things. But they do have that $5, and you're competing for their beer money as an author. And if you don't get them through the retail store, you can get them at the library, especially now that we've all got direct access to library distribution through Overdrive through Kobo, which is brilliant. By the way, going to Overdrive through Kobo is the most financially advantageous path. Draft to Digital and Smashwords also gets there. Smashwords gets you there in a crappy catalog corner that you can't see. Draft to Digital gets you there in a very nice corner of the catalog that they actually look at, that library buyers actually look at. And Kobo gets you straight into the catalog as well. And because Rakuten owns both Overdrive and Kobo, you get a better financial deal going through Kobo to Overdrive than you do going through Draft to Digital to Overdrive. Side note. But you get the poor customers through the libraries if you don't get them through the retail channels. And you can also pick them up on sales, do promotional things, drop to 99 cents for a couple of weeks like I've done for Suave Rob Book 1 for the next couple of days. It's still at 99 cents. You do these things to create a little buzz, to create a little mind share so that people will pick your book up and remember who you are. So I think one way or another I've hit all the pieces of the question. So I'm going to leave it there. But thank you very much for the question, and I'll see you tomorrow.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty Nakian, and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer, and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License, and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners.